You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The term healthcare has come to be more often associated with politics than with medicine these days, with healthcare reform law and the call to curb the costs of programs like Medicare and Medicaid, the subjects of bitter debate. Dr. M. Greg Block looks at how doctors' roles have expanded beyond caring for patients in his new book, The Hippocratic Myth, Why Doctors Are Under Pressure to Ration Care, Practice Politics, and Compromise Their Promise to Heal. Dr. Block is a doctor, a legal scholar, a health policy analyst, and was a health policy advisor to Barack Obama's presidential campaign. His book is published by Palgrave Macmillan, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Thanks so much for having me.
Since you were an advisor to Barack Obama during the presidential campaign, can I assume that this is the Democratic Party's view of the situation?
Not at all. This is my take of the issues. And on the one hand, I am thrilled that we've taken as a society the huge moral step forward that the Affordable Care Act represents, the health reform law. On the other hand, there's work still to be done, and part of this book lays out my own blueprint for how to do that work, the work of cost containment to put this country on a long-haul, physically stable course.
One of the main Republican criticisms of health care reform was that it would lead to rationing, but apparently the House Republicans' budget plan includes changes to that that would move some people off Medicare and onto private insurance. Do you see that as a way to lower not just Medicare costs, but health care costs overall?
It's quite ironic. In our political system, everybody who wants to criticize someone else's attempt to get at costs uses the R word, rationing. Take a look at how the Medicare reform plan proposed by Paul Ryan would work. It would turn Medicare into a voucher system. That voucher system would increase over time, but not nearly as quickly as healthcare costs are increasing. So over time, older people who are middle class, older people who don't have substantial wealth or very high incomes, are going to have to buy cheaper and cheaper health plans. And so long as there's the expectation that those health plans provide all so-called medically necessary care, the reality is going to be that doctors are going to ration their care. That's how the bridge gets covered across. We have to say no sometimes to beneficial care, and we have to find a socially acceptable way to do that. And the kind of covert rationing that would play out under this plan, I think, is deeply troublesome.
Well, this is not just a Republican thing. Many years ago, the governor, Democratic governor of Colorado, kind of suggested that if old people wanted to be considerate to society, they wouldn't ask for all sorts of expensive medical things
Governor
at the
Lamb,
end of their
yes.
lives. The Republican plan posits that if new technologies are more expensive, they won't be used as often. But isn't that rationing?
Well, let me perhaps step away from the word rationing because it's so loaded.
Your subtitle.
Yeah. The reality here is that medical care can do so much more than what we can afford to do. And that gap is widening because the interaction of technology and the payment system, a payment system which leads us to see only a tiny part of the cost, is going to cause the technology to grow. So what do we do about that problem? Over the long haul, one critical thing to do is to slow the development of technologies that are low value but hugely expensive. Crude, high-tech technologies that emphasize engineering, that emphasize computer software, but that don't rest on a sophisticated biological understanding. To the extent we can incentivize medical research to move in a direction that favors technologies that give you more bounce. Take a look at antibiotics and the statin drugs for cholesterol. Those are two examples. That's one thing. But number two.
But things like MRI are what add so much to the expense, and you're not suggesting that we stop using them. CAT scans, PET scans?
What happens in the last years of life, hugely expensive, out of all proportion to what we can afford, to keep somebody alive in an intensive care unit. Let me tell you about Sarah. Sarah was an 82-year-old woman who suffered a massive heart attack while visiting her daughter. She's rushed to the hospital. She's immediately put on the full court press of treatment, tens of thousands of dollars a week in an intensive care unit. Her blood pressure is kept up, And her doctors decide that she isn't going to make it, that her, at least that the chance is very low. They tell her daughter and they tell her that. The daughter becomes furious. The daughter demands aggressive treatment. She gets aggressive treatment. Sarah survives and walks out and lives for another year. So that's a wonderful story, except that the great majority of people in Sarah's position aren't going to make it. So the tragic dimension here is that we have to make the kinds of choices that are going to allow some people not to make it in order to save resources that can do a whole lot more for a whole lot of others.
Frederick Wiseman once made a film in a Boston hospital, and he contrasted the doctor's advice to two different patients' families. Both were on the verge of dying, and they could pull the plug. They kind of encouraged the poor black person's family to pull the plug, but the beloved doctor's wife was encouraged to keep him alive because he was so important to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's a class factor in all of this.
Absolutely.
And race.
I served on the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Racial Disparities some years back, and those are exactly the kinds of questions we
And you're
at.
Also saying age, because in the case of Sarah, it was an age issue, and actually in the case of that doctor in Boston, he was also elderly.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. I think that some doctors do make those kinds of judgments, and the age judgment as well as the judgments that come unconsciously based on differences in empathy, and sometimes those differences in empathy are linked to race. And that's something that we've got to address through medical education. It's also something we need to address by paying doctors more for spending time talking to their patients and less for using fancy procedures with wonderful electronics and beeping machines. To the extent that doctors are rewarded for human engagement, there'll be more of a chance of that kind of empathy. Having said that, that doesn't fully get at the kinds of discretionary judgments that can be profoundly unfair that you're quite properly pointing to.
But I just read that patients prefer for doctors to simply give them a prescription than to sit and tell them that they got to change the way they are living their lives.
Right, right. Especially if we're being told to stop eating brie or pizza or whatever our other favorite fast foods may be. Doctors are functioning in a market and don't want to dissatisfy their customers.
What about the insurance companies? When they make decisions about rationing care, are they really just responding to requests to keep costs down?
Well, they're caught in the middle in our system, and we do sometimes demonize and the deception that insurance companies engage in by promising all medically necessary care and then saying no on the sly is troublesome. But we catch them in the middle. On the one hand, we elect politicians who promise not to raise our taxes. We go shop at Walmart and other places for the cheapest possible products. We send a signal, therefore, to our employers that we want them to keep health care costs low. On the other hand, when we go to our doctors, we want everything for ourselves and our loved ones. And so we do put insurers in the middle of that way.
My guest is M. Greg Bloch, B-L-O-C-H-E. His book, The Hippocratic Myth, Why Doctors Are Under Pressure to Ration Care, Practice Politics, and also to Compromise Their Promise to Heal. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. Mentioned Sarah. You give a number of examples of throughout the book of people's stories, and one of them is of a young woman named Yanira who lived in a poor part of Philadelphia. Her first symptom was a headache.
Right.
What happened to her?
Yanira has a headache, and Yanira has nausea, and she had recently given birth, and she goes a couple of times to a local community hospital in one of the rougher parts of my hometown of Philadelphia. And both times, she's basically shaken off in a busy emergency room and not given critical evaluation. Critical steps in the evaluation don't happen. And this evaluation fails to discern a rapidly growing tumor that she had in her uterus that was that grew from her placenta from her previous pregnancy, a tumor that then metastasizes or spreads into her brain, and that ultimately, within days, grows big enough in her brain to the point that it displaces brain tissue and permanently damages her brain. Had she been evaluated with a more effective physical exam by doctors who were under less of a crush of time in the intensive care unit, she would have gotten critical technological interventions that would have detected this problem, and she could have been saved. As it was, the problem wasn't detected until she suffered massive irreversible brain damage. So that's a story about the basic time spent doing a physical exam not being spent. If the physical exam had been done right, then she would not have then the technology would have been used appropriately.
But the physical exam would have been done right if she'd had more money, if she lived in a better neighborhood.
I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right.
If the hospital didn't feel so much pressure to get people in and out.
Exactly right. And so there's another form of rationing embedded in our system because of the fact that some parts of the system that are not paid for with private health insurance don't have the resources and don't have the staffing. And so they have cutoff levels, cost-benefit cutoff levels, that are tacitly, without even a conscious design, in a different place, much more unfavorable to a patient.
Do insurance companies provide clear cost-benefit formulas for doctors to use as guidelines?
They don't. It's something that nobody wants to talk about.
So doctors have to determine them for themselves?
Doctors, this all ends up being seat of the pants with the kinds of discrimination based on differences in empathy and sometimes even differences in race and ethnicity that you were pointing to before.
So who would you like to see set those standards? The insurers who are most likely to be doing it or the doctors?
Well, we need to have an open conversation about this, first of all. I hope that the proposal that Representative Paul Ryan made the other day, I'm not much of a fan of that proposal. I think it's profoundly troubling in its social and economic inequity. But I hope it at least gets a serious conversation started about how we go about setting limits.
It's not often clear what's covered by insurance plans and what's not.
Right, exactly.
So insurance companies' cost control policies aren't known to patients.
That's right.
They get a notice that something they thought was going to be covered is not being covered, and they're going to have to pay the doctor.
Not only that, but a lot of insurance companies still take the position that their protocols for coverage are proprietary, that is, are trade secrets. And that if the protocols were made known, that doctors and patients would game the system. That would be like keeping the laws secret because we don't want lawyers to game the system by giving their clients advice about what's legal and illegal.
And what are the determining factors? As a doctor who's had to deal with them and wondered why they paid for this thing and not that thing, do you have any sense? Is it simply a matter of money?
Of course it's about money. And I think doctors get a sense that different plans have different attitudes and different philosophies. And if a doctor has a lot of patients in one plan, he or she will develop that sense. But so long as they're keeping their practice protocols for payment proprietary or secret, it's impossible for a doctor to always know in advance. But it is possible for a doctor and it is possible for a patient. And this is part of the message of the book to people who become patients, is that there's a news you can use dimension here. It is possible to take advantage of the disconnect between the promise of medically necessary care and the reality of covert rationing, to take advantage of this disconnect by pointing to possible ways that a treatment could be of benefit and by getting a medical opinion to that effect when you appeal your insurance company's denial. And if you do that effectively, you will typically prevail. And on behalf of some friends and colleagues, I've done that and I've never lost one.
Although you got to spend an awful lot of time on the phone.
Oh, yes.
And one of the big complaints doctors have is that the cost of their practice has gone up considerably because they have to have somebody who's on the phone all the time to insurance companies.
Right, or producing the appellate paperwork. To take an appeal to an independent review board, you basically have to submit a document that's several pages or more long. You have to compose it carefully, like a good piece of legal advocacy, cite the literature, et cetera.
My guest is M. Greg Block, who is a health policy expert, professor of law, so he actually can produce those legal documents, professor of law at Georgetown University. He's written for the New York Times, the New England Journal of Medicine, and other leading publications. And he has written a book called The Hippocratic Myth, and it's published by Palgrave Macmillan. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with M. Greg Block. He's written a book called The Hippocratic Oath, why doctors are under pressure to ration their care, practice politics, and compromise their promise to heal. It's published by Paul Gregg McMillan. So why is healthcare so expensive in this country? You write that in 25 years, we'll spend a third of our national wealth on healthcare. That means that it's really growing fast.
That's right. That's right.
5 to 10% annual increase.
Several percentage points ahead of the rate of inflation every year for several decades or more. Take the Medicare program. It's now about 5% of our gross domestic product. It's expected to rise in, I think, 20 to 25 years to 10% of our gross domestic product. We talk about Social Security being in need of a fix. That's also 5% of our gross domestic product today. In 20 to 25 years, it will be 6%. So healthcare is rising out of all proportion to what we can afford to deal with.
Is it rising everywhere? There are people in Congress who say, well, if we move in the direction that President Obama is suggesting, we're going to wind up being like Western Europeans. Well, I got sick in Germany once, and I was very pleased with the health care I got. I had to pay, but it sure was a lot less than I would have paid here.
It is lower in every other country in the world, but the rates of increase are similar. Every developed industrialized country has a health care cost problem or crisis. The lines going upward are at different places, but they're going up in parallel. And so that's the it's a worldwide problem. And it's a problem because insurance is not just paying for today's technologies. It's creating the expectation for those who develop future technologies that what they develop will be paid for, even if it doesn't add enough value to be worth it.
What you call halfway technology.
That's right. That's right.
Now, the alternative, of course, is that they don't use the technology, and then somebody it's determined that somebody could have died because they didn't use the technology, and then you wind up with a malpractice suit. A lot of doctors say that they're practicing defensive medicine.
Yeah, a lot of doctors say this, but this has actually been pretty well studied. And the cost of the medical malpractice system itself is probably only a fraction of a percentage point of what we spend on healthcare in this country. And even if you add the best estimates of so-called defensive medicine, that is medicine practiced only because of fear of legal intervention, you probably get up to, this is a rough ballpark figure, you don't get higher than 5% of all that we spend on healthcare. So if you took away the whole medical malpractice system, including defensive medicine, with just one swing of the bat, a Barry Bonds swing of the bat, then what you'd do is you'd eliminate maybe roughly 1 year's increase in healthcare spending. And of course, you can't take it away every year. The next year, it's already gone, and we're going to go ahead and increase 4 or 5%. So the medical malpractice system is simply not a substantial long-term driver of our healthcare spending. It's a political point that Republicans tend to make, and perhaps it's more than anything a failure of our news media that there isn't enough fact-checking.
They call for caps on malpractice awards.
Yeah, yeah.
And wouldn't that keep costs down?
If we're talking about something that in its totality costs 1% of the healthcare system, roughly, plus let's add on another 4 or 5% for defensive medicine. We're just not talking about a large part of the animal.
How is new technology usually tested?
Ah, that is one of the bugbears of the system. It's usually not. The best testing is done for new drugs. And that testing doesn't assess the extra value that a new drug might add by comparison to an existing drug. That testing, per the statute that created the Food and Drug Administration, only requires that a drug be established as safe and effective. But compared to what? There isn't a compared to what question. And for technologies, there isn't even that test. To some extent, for new medical devices, there is. But a new surgical procedure doesn't have to pass muster as safe and effective or as having higher value in order to get covered by insurers, typically.
The 2010 healthcare reform law calls for a patient-centered outcomes research institute.
Right.
What would that do?
Well, this is a big positive step in the healthcare reform law. For the first time, we're going to be embarking upon a a coherent and well-funded program of clinical outcomes research. The vast majority of decisions that doctors make don't rest on science. This is stunning. The average patient probably doesn't know this. The average person would probably be astonished to find this out. But this is conventional wisdom, understood, acknowledged amongst doctors. And so to the extent we can do randomized clinical trials and even other studies that might be less scientifically sound but still practical in order to get better answers about what tests and treatments work, that's a huge advance. Of course, there will always be profound limits. Patients are always different, and there's the question of whether real-world patients fit into the criteria for the clinical trial.
Who would fund this research institute?
This is a research agenda that's going to be jointly funded by the federal government and by private insurers. They will be contributing as well. A worry about the way that this plan is designed, and this reflects the fact that due to political idiosyncrasies, the Scott Brown election replacing Ted Kennedy, et cetera, it was the Senate bill, not the House bill, that for the most part became law. This body is going to be coordinated. It's going to be led by a steering group composed of representatives of the various health sector of industries, doctors, hospitals, insurers, et cetera. So you have to worry. We have to worry about whether they're going to strike interest group deals in order to not investigate certain treatments that are major revenue producers. I do worry about that.
Can you talk about the development of informed consent in medicine? Why is it needed?
Yeah, sure. It develops spasmodically more in its absence than its presence through the early 20th century and as it was realized that people were taking risks to determine whether treatments worked or not. The nightmare of Nazi medicine and the only slightly lesser nightmare of Japanese World War II medicine led to a sense of outrage about excesses. The Nuremberg Code, promulgated by one of the Nuremberg tribunals, called for informed consent to human subjects research. And that spread in the 1970s in this country from the research realm to the clinical realm. And by the end of the 70s, it was an established legal and ethical norm that doctors had to get the informed consent of their patients for all tests and treatments that involve significant risk.
Wouldn't that already have been included in the Hippocratic Oath?
This is a really interesting question. This is a fascinating question. The traditional Hippocratic ideal relies upon the doctor's goodness, the doctor's commitment to patients, to take care of the patient. And so the bioethics movement, beginning in the 1960s, flowering in the 1970s, says that's not enough to protect patients. Doctors' paternalism, perhaps self-serving paternalism, needs to be protected against, and the way that we should do that is by adding to the Hippocratic ideal this new ideal of autonomy enforced through a requirement of informed consent. Part of what happened is that as medicine became specialized, our doctors became strangers to us, and increasingly there was the sense that we couldn't count on our doctors to stand by us and our interests for a lifetime.
The 2010 healthcare reform law is under attack right now as the budget is being determined. Do you think it's going to remain intact, or do you think that it's going to be eaten away as at least members of the House would like to see it eaten away?
I think it survives. I think that there's a whole lot of noise, and rather than paying attention to all the noise being made on the House side in Washington, it's probably best to look at what's happening in the states, where in 50 different states and other jurisdictions, there's vigorous efforts underway to implement the law, to set up insurance exchanges, to revise Medicaid programs, to make them available to poor people. And so I think this is a historic moral advance that some noise in Washington is not going to stand in the way of.
Just one more thing. A caller brought up the fact that the insurance system takes decisions out of the hands of doctors. How can we return to a system where the doctor isn't pressured by factors like cost?
We will never return to a system. We'll never reach a system where the doctor isn't pressured by factors like cost. In every other aspect of our lives, cost matters. When the Federal Aviation Administration sets airline safety regulations, it does so based on a formula that gives economic value to a life. When OSHA sets regulations, it does the same. Federal agencies typically will value a life at between $5 and $10 million. And we, in our own choices about the risks we take in our jobs, the risks we take when we buy products, we make those kinds of implicit choices. So cost is always going to be part of the equation. What I'd like to see is for consideration of cost to become more honest so that people don't feel that they've been profoundly hustled.
Dr. M. Greg Block's book is called The Hippocratic Myth, Why Doctors Are Under Pressure to Ration Care, Practice Politics, and Compromise Their Promise to Heal. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.